So I've changed the title of my talk and also the contents, and it's going to be kind of anticlimax after Benji's talk. I'm going to talk on two problems, neither of which I've worked on, but there's no harm in discussing some problems even if you have not worked on it. So I'll just tell what those problems are first. Can you hear me? What is to be done here? Okay. So the two problems that I want to discuss are the following. One is the well-known invariance of stress problem, and the other one is problem of Furstenberg. So invariance of stress problem I will take a little later. So and the problem of Furstenberg is the one about on S1 you have two actions, Z going to Z square and Z going to Z cube, and the question is whether Lebesgue measure is only invariant measure for these actions together. Each individually has lots of invariant probability measures there. And as I said, I don't have expertise in this problem as well as invariant success problem. And really, Rudolf and Amy Johnson are experts on this. And there are many other people on Peter Rosenthal and others are expert on the problem, other problem. So you'll forgive me if I kind of okay. So what is, so let me begin with the invariant success problem. So every bounded linear operator on a Hilbert space of dimension bigger than or equal to 2 has n proper invariant subspace. So this is a statement, and doesn't know it is true or false. And when I say subspace, it will always mean closed subspaces. Okay. Now there is a classical reformulation which was quite discussed extensively in the 60s and the late 50s, or in the 50s. So I'll first try to recall that formulation, and it is in terms of isometries. So I have an Hilbert space H, and by Hilbert space I will always mean complex separable Hilbert space. So S is an isometry on H, is a complex separable. S is called exact or pure or completely non-unitary, depending on non-unitary. We'll call it exact if intersection S and H is good. So that is what we mean by exact isometry, and it is quickly given what kind. Its structure is immediately known. Anyway, if we have little L2, space of sequences, it's sum of the squares finite, then S of is an isometry, and we know that this is an exact isometry. And more generally, instead of taking sequences of complex numbers, you can take sequences in a Hilbert space. So you can take a Hilbert space W and write H for the direct sum . So an element here would be, say, with summation finite, and in isometry S would be and every exact isometry is necessarily of this type. This is corresponds to one ring space which I have an exact isometry. I just recall for you how it is done. If H is an arbitrary Hilbert space and S is an exact isometry, then we look at W equal to H minus SH. This becomes a one ring space, and if you have this property, then direct sum of S to the power NW is all of H, and S to the power NW is just an isomorphic copy of W, so you have that. And the dimension of W is kind of complete invariant for exact isometries. Okay, so that much. And of course, this is an isometry which is not unitary clearly, and S star of W1, W2 is the other shift, W2, W3 and so on. And you can see that S star S is a good identity. And this is a contraction, because the norm of SW could possibly be less than the norm of W. So this is a contraction. Now there is a nice theorem proved in the 60s sometime, attributed to many different authors. I think Rota is one of them. And it is that if I take any contraction, if T is a contraction, means let us take T, norm of T less than 1. Of course, for invariant success problem, it is enough to consider operators like this, because if T is any operator, I could multiply it by constant to make it a contraction, and invariant subspace question would remain the same. So this theorem of is the following. Every contraction. Okay, no, I think before I go, I have to explain a little more. So I have an isometry, complete exact isometry. So let S be an exact isometry on H. A subspace K in H is S invariant, is S invariant if SK is contained in K, then it is called S invariant. In that case, if I take K perp, which is the orthogonal complement of K in H, then K perp is invariant under S star. Is contained in K perp. So S star acts on K perp. You can forget about the rest of it. And since it is a contraction there, it is a contraction on K perp. And the theorem that I was going to state is the following. And proof is not very hard. Well, it takes about half a page or one page in Hilbert space book. It is that every contraction T is conjugate or similar to S star restricted to K perp for a suitable S invariant subspace K of H. In other words, what I want to say is that really what I mean is given any contraction T, you can find an exact isometry on a Hilbert space, on a suitable Hilbert space, and a S invariant subspace such that a star restricted to K perp is isomorphic to T, or its conjugate to T. Conjugate means there is a invertible operator A such that A T A inverse. In other words, what I mean is, if suppose T is on certain space M, then there is an operator A from M to some Hilbert space H on which there is an isometry, and then you have this A T A inverse equal to this invertible bounded linear operator equal to S star restricted to K perp. Okay.
Now, I missed the point about you're saying every contraction T that is an S invariant subspace. But are you saying that is an S, or are you saying that this works for any exact isometry?
Well, if you have, let me put it this way, if your W is infinite dimensional, then it's okay, then there will be no problem. You see, what I want to say is that if you take this H, which W is infinite dimensional, and you have an isometry, then it's okay. But
you will be able to
find do that, yeah. Otherwise, so it is, if you are given a contraction T, you can find a Hilbert space and an isometry S star, S, exact isometry S, and all this. Okay. So anyway, this should be from, say, M2, K perp. Then we'll have this. So in other words, invariant subspace problem, rather than consider generally, you could simply look at S star acting on K perp for suitable K perp. Okay, so what does this mean? Now, okay, so suppose S star acting on K perp admits a proper invariant subspace. And let me call that subspace, rather than call L, let me call it L perp. There is no harm in saying that it is L perp of some L. So suppose admits a proper invariant subspace, say L perp. Then what we have is 0 not equal to L perp, not equal to K perp, and S star of L perp is contained in L perp. This is what we have. Now this, if I take the perps, it means K is contained in L, is contained in H, not equal to, and this translates into S of L is contained in L. So I could say the following, that if S star restricted to K perp admits a proper, well, S star admits a proper S star invariant subspace, if and only if, now there is slight change of language here. Here I am saying that the operator admits a proper invariant subspace. Here I am going to say the following: if and only if K, which is a subspace, admits a proper S invariant superspace. Because this L, I have taken L for with this purpose in mind, this L is S invariant and contains K, not equal to K, and not equal to H, and is a proper invariant superspace to K under S. Okay. So one can reformulate the invariant surface problem as follows, purely for isometries, forgetting about S star. And of course, S star restricted to K will admit, well, question of admitting proper invariant surface comes only if K star is of dimension bigger than 2, K perp is of dimension bigger than 2, otherwise, of course, there is no proper invariant subspace. So I could restate the invariant surface problem here as follows. So, invariant surface problem. Problem is equivalent to the following. If K is every S invariant subspace K is dimension of K perp bigger than or equal to 2 admits a proper S invariant superspace. So that is an equivalent formulation of the invariant surface problem entirely in terms of isometries. Okay. So the question is how to describe invariant surfaces for an isometry. Now here I have taken an abstract setting, but one could do the following. Instead of taking this W plus W plus W, sequences, you could take the following. You can look at all f summation n equal to 0 to infinity an z to the power n an in w and summation an square finite. You consider all such f, or consider all of f like this. So these are, and z is in circle, z is in S1, in the circle. So really this is, such all these functions is really nothing but what in, this is called H2, Hardy space, with values in the Hilbert space W. So this Hardy space is isomorphic to W plus W plus W clearly. And the S, which is the shift, goes into simply S of F multiplication by Z. So that is what the shift is. So this is it in the classical thing that was discussed. It was this space which was looked at. And then if you do that, one can describe the invariant surfaces of interest. Okay, so this is how S looks like. Now, suppose I have this W equal to one dimensional, say C, the complex numbers, then this is really the usual H2, which is discussed in Rudin's book or any other this. And then invariant surface is given by is invariant subspace of H2 for this is of the type say A times H2, where A is a complex function of absolute value 1 on the circle, analytic inside and bounded. So they are what are called inner functions by, this is work done by, you know, this is 1939, this Bergling's theorem that any invariant subspace of little h2 looks like this. Okay. And whether it has proper invariant superspace depends on the structure of A. So if you can factor A, then there is proper invariant superspace. And generally, if you have, this is not scalar, but if you have W is higher dimensional, then it is the following. So let me give examples of invariant subspaces. So let A from circle to unitary operators on H. You could take isometries on H, take any function where A is analytic. Where A has one-sided series. So these will be matrices or unit operators, and AZ has this type, is of this type, and takes values into unitary operators. Okay. So take a function like this, A, and then A times H2 of W. Let us let this for K. So K is an invariant subspace because ZK is contained in K. That one can check. And the question whether it has proper invariant superspace, as in the case of here, you know, Bergling's had a factorization for inner functions, Glaschke product and the other one. The question is whether we can factor this operator A. So K admits a proper. Of course, not in the higher dimension, this is not so important. In the higher dimension case, not every invariant subspace is of this type. But for the purpose of the problem, invariant subspaces of this type are enough to consider. So K admits a proper S invariant superspace if and only if A can be factored as A times B, where A and B are of similar type and non-trivial. Okay, you cannot take one identity and another one like that. So if now, as I said, for the scalar case, Bergling had answer yes, you can factor it. So there is the answer is yes. Every invariant subspace of dimension, you know, satisfying this, will have proper invariant superspace. Same thing is true with little more work if your W is of finite dimension. Okay. If dimension W is finite, and this was done by Foyas, Nash, and Helson and so many other people show that if FW is finite dimensional, then this becomes a unitary operator value, a matrix value function, and then there's the work of Potter, Power, and others that you can factor it. Then A can be factored as A, B times. Yes, of course, this is the B times. So invariant subspace problem is of has a solution. What I mean is, if A is W is finite dimensional, then there is always admits a finite. So invariant subspace problem is of interest, therefore. So the question arises, therefore, when W is infinite dimensional and A is such a thing, can you always factor A? That is old. So invariant subspace problem. System asking is every A from S1 to, which of this type, these are called inner functions, or what, operator inner functions. I'm sorry, this is not your section, it would be, okay, I don't, you should be, you, doesn't matter, can be factored. As B times C, when dimension W is infinity. So that is the question. So that's where the problem lies as far as OF formulation is concerned. Okay. Okay, now that's all. What I want to do is slightly differently, and that's the, there is no descriptive thing here so far. You see, any isometry would do, because we know that any two isometries are isomorphic if the bounding surfaces have same dimension. And I'm interested in where the bounding surface is of infinite dimension. Okay. And so, in this kind of approach, what you need is complex function theory and harmonic analysis and things like that. There's no dynamics here. So let me come to the point that descriptive formulation or dynamical formulation of the invariant surface problem. So for that, what I would do, therefore, is to take T is not an operator anymore now. T an exact, any exact endomorphism. Okay, on a probability space. You could take, for example, 0, 1 to the power LF naught, the shift, one-sided shift, with Bernoulli measure half half, that would be an exact endomorphism. So exact endomorphism, let me explain what I mean, therefore, is that intersection, this is measure preserving transformation on a probability space, standard measure space, XBM, and T to the power NB, minus NB, n equal to 0 to infinity, consists of only the empty space and the whole space mod M. So this is as every setting there as either measure 0 or 1. So that is what I mean by an exact endomorphism. And then I take my H to be L2 of X okay. And F put F composite T. And because of this property, and because I have taken L2 0, functions vanishing whose integrals vanish, this becomes an exact isometry. And now from we know from, you know, you can find it in any ergodic theory book, that H minus SH has infinite W. This is of infinite dimension, is of, has infinite dimension. So this comes free, this comes free. There I have to impose it from outside, but this comes free. Okay. And one can try to ask, therefore this is a nice setting, and one can ask what kind of invariant subspaces come into picture as far as invariant subspace problem is concerned. So suppose I have an invariant subspace K. So this is the dynamical formulation that I want to consider. So now here functions, you know, many functions in here, they are really equivalence classes. So I have to clarify what I mean from here on. So I take a countable number of collection of Borel functions, which are dense, and look at the sigma algebra generated by that. Okay. So let me call that F. And if F is equal to B mod modulo M, then I'll say that functions in k-separate points. That's what I mean by functions in k-separate points. I will mean this specific thing. Okay, that's just a matter of language I'm having for this purpose of this lecture. Okay, so I have this F, which is the sigma algebra generated by functions in K, but really countable collection of Borel functions which are dense. That is this F, this countably generated sigma algebra. And this has the property that T inverse script F is contained in script F. So let me now say what I mean. Now there are two possibilities. Either the script F separates points, that means it is essentially equal to the whole of B, or it is not. Okay, suppose it is not. So in other words, what I want to say is the following. If K is contained in L2 0 of X script F M and not equal to, okay, and F does not separate points. Then this particular K admits a proper invariant superspace, namely this. This is going to be S invariant because of this property, and this is not going to be whole of it because I assume that this does not separate points. So K admits a proper invariant superspace, so such spaces are not of no interest in that sense. All right. So either from the point of view of invariant subspace problem, the subspaces K which are of interest to me are those of this type, where F is not the whole thing, or those K whose functions separate points. These are the two kinds of subspaces that are of interest. Okay. So now the question is, suppose I have, so now let me define what is a factor. A countably generated subsigma algebra script F is a factor. You see, we are in an endomorphism situation, so factor is defined to be defined like this. Okay, and then we have L2 of X script F N. So if F is a proper factor, which is, that means it is not the whole space, then I want to look at this. So I want to make a definition. Call script F factor maximal, like proper. Maximal if any G, if any factor G which lies between script F and B, which lies between these two, coincides with either F with either with G or with B, with F or with B. So such a factor is called maximal. Naturally, if I take a invariant subspace of this type, and if F is not maximal, then it has a proper invariant superspace, namely L2 of X, G, B, M. So from the point of view of invariant subspace problem, only maximal factors are of interest. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And F is not separated point, then.
Then this K admits a proper invariant superspace. Namely this.
That's all you mean.
Yeah. Yes, trivial proper invariant superspace. Okay. Similarly, so one has to look at only subspaces of this type or subspaces which whose function separate points. So if it is of this type, then we have to look at only maximal factors, not otherwise. But that is not enough, so I have to make a new definition, may call it strongly maximal. All F. Strongly maximal. All these definitions are just concocted to suit the purpose. So, for strongly maximal, if there is no proper F invariant so space of L2 0 M strictly containing this is what I mean by strongly maximal. And surely if this factor is strongly maximal, then it is maximal.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. So now I will say what I mean by the dynamical formulation of the invariant surface problem. So affirmative answer to the invariant surface problem is equivalent to the following. What is that? There are no strongly maximal factors, okay. And every closed S invariant, well, closed I need not say my invariant subspace, because I said subspace means closed. Every S invariant of space separating subspace. Every closed S invariant of space of M separating points. Points, say K, closed invariant subspace K of L2 separating points, and dimension K per 2 admits the proper S invariant superspace. So this is, in some sense, a reformulation of the invariant surface problem. But now there is dynamics. Earlier there was harmonic analysis and complex function theory, and now there is some dynamics at least to lay and handle on. Now question is, do the maximal factors exist? They do. I'll quickly give an example, although I don't know very great general structure. Okay, so let me finish this topic by giving an example of a maximal factor, but it is not strongly maximal. So let me take circle group and script F symmetric sigma algebra of symmetric set of symmetric Borel sets. Now by symmetric I mean Z and minus Z are the atoms, not Z and Z complex conjugate. If Z is there in the set, then its antipodal point is also in the, in that sense, symmetric. Okay, so this is script F. Now this script F, I will give you two transformations, sigma Z going to Z square. I'm going to use the same notation in the first Rimmel's discussion problem, or the first Rimmel's problem, discussion of the first Rimmel's problem, and tau Z going to Z cube. This is a factor for both these transformations. This is not maximal for this transformation. It is a maximal factor for this transformation, Z going to Z cube. Okay. But it is not strongly maximal. So there I think I want to complete the discussion. I don't want to discuss any. That's all I know about these things. And by the way, I should now mention how this came about. I was in Torun for part of the summer, and Lemanczyk asked me some question on spectral theory, and I don't want to mention the question, but when I thought about the question and did something, I realized that, you know, it is really a reformulation of the invariant surface problem for the in the dynamical setting. So I just wanted to put that. Yeah. So now let me go to the another problem where I don't have much expertise. But no, if they existed, the invariant surface problem would be solved. Okay, so that is, if you show the existence of the strongly maximal surface, you solve the invariant surface problem. Okay, one more thing. Maximal factors have full entropy. In other words, you cannot have maximal, if the entropy of the given endomorphism is, say, alpha, the entropy of T restricted to the maximal factor is also alpha. It cannot be smaller. One can show that if you are smaller, then you can get a bigger. So entropy comes in some strange way. And I'm not sure. But if you want to have a counterexample, then you'll have to look at some specific endomorphisms. And I don't know why. You know, I don't have expertise. But there could be, for example, K-automorphisms in which you have maximal Bernoulli factor. And one doesn't know if it is. It could be strongly maximal or not. I don't know. So now I think some more time, 15 minutes. I'll discuss the other problem. Here too, I mean, I'm not going to solve the problem, but say where the problem arises, problem lies. Okay, so I have this circle group S1, and I have two transformations, sigma Z going to Z square and tau Z going to Z cube. Now this is a problem discussed, raised by Fastenberg, and first contribution was by Russell Lyons, who showed that if one of the them is an exact endomorphism, then the answer is yes. Entropy comes into picture. Then Rudolf showed that if the joint action is ergodic, but you cannot assume that any of the individual actions is ergodic, that would make simplify the problem. If joint action is ergodic and one of them has positive entropy, then Liebig measures the only one which is invariant under the two transformations. And then there's the work of Amy Johnson and Rudolph's proof was simplified by or Host gave a simpler proof. But I'm not going to discuss any of that. I'm going to discuss from the descriptive set theory or some, not exactly descriptive set, a certain point of view. Let us see what that means. Okay. And I'm going to, generally they take z to the power p and z to the power q, where p, q, p and q are relatively prime. But to keep the discussion simple, I will take only z going to z square and z going to z cube. Okay. Okay. So let me first consider tau. And the following is true. Okay. So if mu is tau invariant and ergodic, then either mu is symmetric or there exists a support C of mu such that C intersection minus C is empty. In other words, if mu is tau ergodic and invariant under tau, then it is either symmetric or it is antisymmetric. Symmetric means symmetric set here, and it's, they have the same measure. Okay, that's what I mean by saying that it's symmetric. So only one of the things is possible. Okay. Next, we can decompose S1 in an, you can have a measurable decomposition of S1 in the following form, union C alpha, union N, alpha in 0, 1, okay, where each alpha, each C alpha, supports a unique tau invariant probability measure. And N is the complement of all that. Okay. Okay. So N, in other words, consists of all those Z such that tau to the power nz has no distribution whatsoever. If there is, then it is in N. Okay. And among these, I will have C0, which I will have C0 is all z such that tau to the power nz has uniform distribution. So that is a special notation I have for C0. Now it turns out, although these are endomorphisms, they are not invertible, this sigma acts on C alpha in an onto and measurable fashion. Acts on C alpha in a measurable fashion and onto manner. In other words, if I apply sigma to any C alpha, I get a set which is again another C alpha. Okay, and every C alpha occurs in this way. Okay. Then one can write down how a measure which is invariant under sigma and tau looks like. If mu is invariant under sigma and tau, then okay, means of the form. You can write this in two ways. New way, this is really in direct integral decomposition. Integral 0, 1, mu alpha. A nu d alpha, where nu is sigma invariant on C alpha on this. If you don't like sigma invariant measure on that, one can write it slightly differently. What one can do for Z in C alpha, I can write mu Z equal to mu alpha. Okay. In that case, mu has a representation, mu A, integral over S1, mu alpha, mu Z, A, nu dz, where nu is sigma invariant on S1. One can do it either this way or this way. I can write. So that gives you the structure of measures. Now, because these are invariant under sigma and this is invariant under, these are invariant under tau and this is invariant under sigma, that measure is invariant under both sigma and tau, and every measure is of this type. So it can be written this way. Okay. So I may take just 5 minutes more then. I don't know. Tell me when time is up. So. Okay. So what do I have to say now? The following. Now another thing, fact which is easily proved, is that if mu is sigma invariant and symmetric, then mu is Lebesgue. That is proved very easily with just very elementary number theory, very elementary number theory, but that's as an exercise, one can show that if mu is sigma invariant and symmetric, then mu is a Lebesgue measure. Okay. Now, this decomposition, I can have the following. So, I take H equal to union C alpha, where C alpha is not symmetric. And C naught are those where tau has uniform, orbits of tau have uniform distribution. So C naught is a full measure and it is symmetric and none of them intersect C alpha. So H has Lebesgue measure 0. L stands for the Lebesgue measure. L has Lebesgue measure 0. Hence also therefore sigma to the power minus nh. That too has Lebesgue measure 0. And suppose, so this, let me call it, call this set D. It's, this set is D, and R, let me write, is the complement of D, or rather, union of all C alphas minus D, that is R. Okay. So if C alpha is in R, then mu alpha is, which is invariant tau ergodic measure on C alpha, is symmetric. And surely C naught is in R. Okay. So this integral, I can split this one, for example, or this one I could do either way, as 1 on R, and plus 1 on D. because both of them are invariant under the sigma action. This is invariant sigma action, R is invariant sigma. So I can write this Rn, invariant in Rn. But here, mu z is symmetric. And this measure is going to be invariant under sigma as well as symmetric. So this is going to be necessarily Lebesgue measure. Okay. And so this is the remaining part. So this, what I want to say in other words is that if I have a new sigma invariant measure, say let us say I got it, I don't need ergodic really. If I take any sigma invariant measure, then sigma of R minus D has measure 0. See, let us say, because if it did not have measure 0, this would have a singular part. When I do denew here, that would have a singular part. That cannot happen, because I know that that is always a Lebesgue measure. So the question, therefore, of first number reduces to the following. There exists singular measure mu invariant under sigma and tau. If there exists a sigma invariant measure, continuous, well, measure with measure nu with nu of H positive. In other words, the second part, which I had wrote down here, this should be non-trivial. So I think that's where I will stop.